Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Pete Rose is famous. Shoeless Joe Jackson is famous. Why aren't they in the Baseball Hall of Fame? Roger Clemens is famous. Barry Bonds is famous. Will they be voted into the Hall of Fame when the time comes, or will the Baseball Writers Association decide that Clemens and Bonds, like Rose and Jackson, don't deserve enshrinement? Will a significant number of those writers conclude that the presence of Clemens and Bonds would diminish the institution? Cooperstown Confidential, a new book by Zev Chaffetz, provides an excellent background for consideration of these questions. He examines the history behind the hall, celebrates what fun a visit to Cooperstown can be, and offers the baseball establishment a way to move beyond hypocrisy and pomposity to a less pretentious, more sensible way of celebrating itself and its most accomplished players. When I had the opportunity to speak with Zev Chaffetz this week, I began our conversation by bringing up Ty Cobb, who was a member of the first group of players inducted into the hall. I asked Mr. Chaffetz what would have happened if the writers of Cobb's day had applied the so-called character clause to Mr. Cobb.
Well, probably nothing would happen because the hall's character clause, which says that only players of integrity and sportsmanship and good character can be inducted, has never been actually honored since it was first enacted in 1944.
I don't know if Cobb was the worst of the bunch. As I mentioned in the introduction, you list a reformed cokehead, a celebrated sex addict, a convicted drug dealer. I know the sex addict was Wade Boggs. I'm not sure who all the other guys were. But was Cobb the worst of the bunch?
Well, Cobb was pretty bad. Cobb once bragged to a sports writer that he murdered somebody. And although nobody could turn up any evidence of that, it's still a guy who brags about killing somebody like that is a pretty bad guy. On the other hand, there were two members of the Hall of Fame who were in the Ku Klux Klan that we know of, Tris Speaker and Rogers Hornsby. Joe DiMaggio and Hank Greenberg, who I love dearly, both had very intimate mob ties. So did Leo DeRocher. I guess it depends on what you think a bad character is.
Players elected to the hall get a plaque describing their accomplishments, and they get a ceremony honoring their achievements. They also receive considerable financial benefits. Describe some of those.
Well, there are certain players that getting into the Hall of Fame is not so economically important for them because they're transcendent stars, a guy like Koufax, who only signs a couple of times a year. But for marginal Hall of Famers, for example, Jim Rice, who's being inducted this weekend, it's a huge bonanza. Everything they touch after they can write HOF after their name triples in value immediately. Their autographs, their speaking fees, their appearance fees, their endorsement fees. And for many of them, it's a lifetime annuity.
You write of some of the retired players who've had, quote, whole corporations working to get them into Cooperstown. Who are some of those players, and how does that process work?
Players who want to get into the Hall of Fame and who aren't obvious selections in the past had been rather discreet about how they campaign, because the mythology is that you simply ascend to the Hall of Fame like an angel ascending to the right hand of God. In reality, even going back, let's take Bob Lemon, the pitcher, 25 years ago or so when he was trying to get in, he sent a box with a lemon to every one of the baseball writers who constitute the Electoral College for the Hall. Today, that would be considered a pretty primitive means of campaigning. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples I used in Cooperstown Confidential is that Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, wanted to get Dave Concepcion into the Hall of Fame. And what they did was they simply hired a political consultant in Washington, a lobbyist, who opened an office and worked for several years for Concepcion.
How did that Dave Concepcion campaign work out?
Not too well. He didn't get in. He went past his 15 years of eligibility for the writers, and I think it's pretty clear he's not going to get in. On a veterans vote, the Hall of Famers comprise a committee of the whole of veterans, and their theoretical job is to vote in candidates who didn't get in the first 15 years of the writers voting. Mm-hmm. But since the Hall of Famers have had that job, they've never voted anybody in. And I once asked Marvin Miller why that was, and he said, well, figure it out. You know, being in the Hall of Fame is worth a considerable amount of money, and people don't like to dilute the value of their membership or ownership of a stock. And so if there are 62 living Hall of Famers now, adding additional Hall of Famers means diluting the value per head of membership in the Hall of Fame.
Fans of the Boston Red Sox may be discouraged to read in your book that, quote, Carl Yastrzemski is the Hall of Fame's most infamous living misanthrope. How did Yaz earn that distinction?
You know, I'd never met him, and I only am going by his reputation among all of the various kinds of people I talked to, former players and memorabilia people and baseball executives and others who've come into contact with him. And everybody says that he's the most disliked Hall of Famer. Another one who is not well-liked is Bob Feller, but people cut him slack because he's rather old now, and they say that he's gotten grumpier as he's gotten older.
I have been told that Carl Yastrzemski will be there for tomorrow's ceremony, since Jim Rice is going in, the man who replaced Yastrzemski in left field at Fenway Park, and it's the first time Yaz has been there since his own induction.
Well, I'm glad you told me that he's going to be there. I'll make sure not to be. Actually, I wanted to go to Cooperstown this year, and we couldn't find a bookstore in Cooperstown that wanted to set up a table for me to sell books.
Well, this is astonishing to me, since you're promoting Cooperstown and the Hall of Fame so energetically.
Well, you know, I happen to be a great fan of Cooperstown, and I wouldn't have spent so much time writing about it if I thought it was trivial or unimportant. But I don't think that the Hall of Fame is a quasi-religious shrine, and I don't think that it has the power to immortalize people. And, you know, I think it gets a little bit full of itself.
The myth that baseball began in Cooperstown, New York, under the supervision of Abner Doubleday, has been debunked over and over again. But why did those who created the myth feel that it was necessary to do so?
You know, it's an interesting story because it takes place on the background of a time not so different from ours, when there was a huge wave of foreign immigration to the United States. And the establishment here thought that it would be a good thing to have sort of anchor institutions that everyone could identify with as American. And one of those was baseball. But the problem was that the leading expert was Henry Chadwick, and he said that baseball was invented in England. And so they didn't want the national game of America to be a foreign game. So they formed a public commission called the Mills Commission, with some ex-senators and other public figures. And they determined that baseball was invented in Cooperstown in 1839. This is a total myth. And in fact, Abner Doubleday, who was a general in the Civil War on the Union side, wrote a couple of memoirs, and he never even mentioned baseball. Do you think that a guy who invented the national game would have remembered that in his memoirs?
What has all your research concerning the Hall of Fame led you to conclude about the fact that Pete Rose, the most accomplished hitter in Major League history, at least in terms of volume, is not in the Hall of Fame?
Well, it didn't take a lot of research to determine that, from my perspective, he should be in the Hall of Fame. I think the Hall of Fame is an institution that honors great baseball players, not great citizens. And I wouldn't argue with anyone who said that Pete Rose was a gambler and a liar. You know, he lied to the commissioner of baseball, which I guess is some sort of a terrible crime. But he clearly is one of the great players of all time. And, you know, it doesn't hurt him not to be in the hall nearly so much as it hurts the hall, because it makes it an incomplete place. And I would add, by the way, that Joe Jackson should also be in the Hall of Fame because, A, he was acquitted in the Black Sox scandal, which most people don't remember. But more than that, the whole thing was in 1919. This country has managed to forgive the Germans, the Japanese, the Korean communists, everybody. You know, it's been 90 years.
But not it's Joe Jackson.
Not Joe Jackson. He's like the last unforgiven figure. I think that he should be forgiven and put in, too.
There has been much discussion of how potential Hall of Famers like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, and Alex Rodriguez will fare when they become eligible for election. In your book, you short-circuit that discussion by recommending that the Hall should eliminate the character clause altogether. How would that work?
Well, it would be very simple. The Hall would say, please vote for the most qualified, best players of their time. The fact that some players used, you know, performance-enhancing drugs is basically meaningless on that scale of evaluation because most of the players were probably using. And, you know, not everybody hit 73 home runs in a season, and not everybody pitched like Roger Clemens. Players have always played in a specific context, whether it was the dead ball era or whether it was the time before blacks and Hispanics were in baseball or whether it was before expansion or before the end of the reserve clause. Baseball has evolved over time.
Do you think there's any chance that those in charge of the Hall of Fame and Major League Baseball will go along with your, I must say, very sensible suggestion?
Well, I don't think they're going to have any choice. I mean, at some point, what can they do? Either they can make everyone in baseball into a suspect. And we know perfectly well that, you know, the guys who were mentioned in the Mitchell report and the guys in the 2003 test lists, there are hundreds of them. And that only scratches the surface. So do they really want a Hall of Fame that doesn't have the transcendent players of the last, say, 20 years and of the future? Because in the future, players will continue to use, as they have always used, you know, Pud Galvin in 1889 ingested monkey testosterone, and he's in the Hall of Fame. Mickey Mantle used amphetamines and steroids in 1961 during his home run race with Roger Maris. So, you know, they're not going to have any choice, I don't think. I think they're going to have to just bite the bullet on this, excuse the cliche, and say, yeah, that's baseball in the modern era, and that's what the players have done. And we're going to continue as we have to choose the very best players of the era.
Zev Chaffetz is the author of Cooperstown Confidential, Heroes, Rogues, and the Inside Story of the Baseball Hall of Fame, published by Bloomsbury. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Zev, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
My conversation with Zev Chaffetz about his new book, Cooperstown Confidential, will be featured in this week's program. We'll also hear a little from the Hall of Fame's most recent inductees, Jim Rice and Ricky Henderson. We'll have a story about what it's like to try to run 100 miles in a race that starts in the dark and ends about 16 hours later if you're really good, and perhaps 30 hours later if you're just determined. We'll hear from some of you via your emails, and we'll also visit Rome, home to an exceptionally ornate swimming complex with a controversial history. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.